Antivero.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Ken McDermott-Rowe. Welcome to In Context. We're WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. We'll be giving out our phone number a little later in the show. I'm here with my fellow host, Gus Tinovaro.
Hey, everybody.
And behind the boards doing double duty is Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, who's also our military affairs commentator.
Good afternoon, folks.
And today's our program is on every Monday from noon until 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. And you can get more information about our show and read our blogs at incontextreport.com. In addition, we are producing and posting videos that relate to the show on YouTube. And you can find those if you just go to YouTube and put in Context Report. Radio and TV, right?
In Context Report.
In Context Report, and yep. We're posting current affairs shows that material we cover in our weekly radio show, and we're also doing videos of a previous WPKN series called History Counts, which were in-depth views at a lot of important stories, such as America's coup d'etat, which aren't covered in the mainstream media. In today's show, we're going to look at two important issues, the state public banking issue and also racial profiling in Connecticut. And to help us discuss these issues, we're very happy to have as our guest David Samuels, the founder of Connecticut's Community Party, a party which focuses on criminal justice reform and economic justice issues. Hello, David. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. David, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. So I'd like to start with the public banking issue. Many members of our audience may not be familiar with the concept. Could you talk a little about what a state public bank is and how you think it would benefit the state of Connecticut?
Well, currently there is one public bank in the United States, and that's the Bank of North Dakota. And really, the primary cause of the economic meltdown that struck this country was the big banks with their casino trading and whatnot. When it comes to a public bank, the difference between a public bank and the big banks is that, of course, the bank would be owned by the state, and the key part of that is we're talking about economic sovereignty here. A public bank would generate revenue for the state. With the big banks, what you see is that the money that those banks make, they go to Wall Street. They go out of the state. The revenue that a public bank would generate would go into the general fund. And that's a really important thing because that money could be used for job creation. It could be used for infrastructure projects. It can be used for preserving and enhancing vital social services. And a real big thing is that it could be used for principal lending for homeowners and small businesses and college students. Now, when the big banks, when they got their bailout money, that was supposedly supposed to enable those banks to lend more money. And what ended up happening is those big banks loaned out less money. And so what we need to do is we need to have a public bank here that could partner with community banks and facilitate principled lending, because it's really that's what's going to get this economy going again.
Right, the big difference is that instead of banks hanging on to the profits to fatten their balance sheets, a state-owned bank would be obligated to give that benefit back to the state in terms of either lower taxes or better infrastructure or public services or whatever. So the big difference there is that we reap the benefits off of the banking instead of the big banks just vulturing the need of the people for loans to take that interest and then turn it into their own bonuses.
Exactly. The big banks are beholden to shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And so their mission is make as much money as they possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a public bank, their mission is to do what is good for the people of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, when we go back to talking about the fact that the bank would generate revenue that would go back into the general fund, that money could be used to fund so many you know, different type of programs and projects at no cost to taxpayers. And I think that's a key thing for people to know is, you know, that's the thing that you see right now is, you know, when you're talking about doing any kind of undertaking statewide, the next thing that you hear is that it's going to entail raising taxes. But if you have a revenue engine like a public bank, then that's not going to happen.
And you mentioned, David, that there is one state that has a state public-owned bank. That's the South Dakota.
North Dakota.
I'm sorry, North Dakota.
Yep, the Bank of North Dakota. Right now, the Bank of North Dakota, their unemployment rate is 3.5%. That's the lowest in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got about $1 billion surplus.
Mm.
When the economic meltdown occurred, they were insulated from that because their bank does not participate in the type of financial activities that put the rest of the country in the toilet.
Like derivatives.
Exactly. And I think, what the opponents of the state bank might try to bring up is that, well, North Dakota, they're rich in natural resources. Well, so were other states that are in the red right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at, what's the difference between what North Dakota is doing and what the rest of the country is doing? The difference is they have a state bank.
And the one important thing to notice here is that when states have their slush funds or their rainy day funds or whatever surpluses they may have, they take most of the states, with the exception of North Dakota, take that money and then give it to Wall Street for them to speculate with so that they can get a return and then pay off their retirement funds or so forth. But what we saw in the past 5 years is that money was just lost. It was just speculated and disappeared. So we have to have all these cuts in people's 401k contributions or their retirement funds.
And it's so clear that this the conventional way of the conventional economic policy, I should say, in this country, it is not working. It's not working on the state level,
mm-hmm.
and it's not working on the national level. The conventional playbook is, okay, when there's a deficit, what do you do is you cut. And what we're seeing now is vital social services that already are underfunded, that are pretty much on the brink of extinction. And, you know, when I'm talking about social services, that doesn't just impact the urban community. I mean, the community party, it is the racial justice group, but it impacts across the board because you have a growing number of people now that are on food stamps, people that are working. That have been forced to go on food stamps.
The working poor.
On the way to the studio, Gus and I were talking about how the criminally low wages Americans are paid, $8 an hour. Nobody can live on that. It's absolutely absurd.
Absolutely. So, you know, what we're talking about here, you know, I'll go back to that term when I say it's economic sovereignty. The Bank of North Dakota, they are insulated from the economic meltdown that hit this country because their bank serves in effect as a mini Fed and they partner with other banks in the state and facilitate lending and it's just a no-brainer and this isn't some far left socialist plot you have Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
That have introduced public bank legislation.
Now, North Dakota is by no means a left-wing
state. Very conservative state. And public banking legislation has been introduced in Virginia and Arizona by Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a national movement.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is not a left-right thing. This is about doing what has to be done and simply implementing new ideas that are needed to get this country's economy back.
How realistic is it to have it come to the state of Connecticut, where we have such a deficit and such a problem with pulling in enough money to even pay our own bills?
Well, I'm not going to lie; it's not going to be easy because the bank lobby they're working hard to stop this. In Oregon, I was on a You know, I was on a conference call a few months ago with someone who's involved with the public banking movement in Oregon, and he pulled no punches. He said that bill that had been basically chopped up and whittled down to nothing by the banking lobby, and even at that point they were having a tough time pushing it through, and that was a result of the big banks spreading misinformation. They were going to the community banks and saying, hey, if the public bank comes to your state, you're going to be out of business, which is a total lie. So he said that what ended up hampering their campaign out there was they had to spend so much time just fighting that misinformation, it really took away from the momentum of the campaign.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I won't sugarcoat this. Mm-hmm. It will be very difficult to get that done here, and what it's going to take is tremendous public pressure.
David, if people want to learn more about the public banking movement in America or in Connecticut, what website could they go to?
People can visit our Facebook page. It's Public Bank for Connecticut, and you know we update it daily. And we were regularly posting articles, about the public banking movement, about bills that are being introduced in other states. I think there might be up to like 17 states right now that have introduced public banking legislation.
And you're also working with Ellen Brown at the Public Banking Institute.
Honestly, no. We were in the beginning. But the problem with the Public Banking Institute is that they really weren't supporting our efforts locally.
I see.
I talked to them about, you know, helping our group to get support or to get partners, I should say, either, you know, in Connecticut or in the Northeast region that could work with us, to really get the effort off of the ground. And what we were told was, okay, once your name is on the website, because it's on their website, they have a list of state coordinators, and I was a state coordinator for Connecticut. Well, what I was told by them is, once people see your name as a Connecticut state coordinator, people, you know, in Connecticut and the Northeast, they'll contact you. And that never happened.
Yeah.
So it's
going to be a big organizing effort to get this going.
It definitely will be. We are in talks with a couple of parties right now about forming a coalition. We're talking about having a public event in May. I really don't want to go into it until we have that nailed down.
Okay.
But once it is confirmed, we will definitely be promoting it. Okay. When we do have a public event, we'll be promoting it heavily on the Public Bank for Connecticut Facebook page. So I would say people should just keep checking there, and also, you know, we have contact information where people can, you know, if they want updates, they can contact us either by phone or email.
And we also have an introduction to public banking video on our YouTube channel for listeners out there who just want a quick, simple introduction in video form.
Is it called In Context Report?
YouTube and search In Context, or youtube.com/In Context Report. That's our website.
And it's a really informative clip. We post that regularly on our page.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
That's great. Well, David, now I'd like to move on to the issue of racial profiling. And to get us started on it, I wonder if you could talk about that February 2009 incident at My Country Store in East Haven, and the role of the so-called Miller's Boys, these East Haven police officers. Could you tell us that story?
Oh, you mean the with Father Manship?
Yes.
Yeah, Father Manship videotaped a couple of the officers that have ended up being indicted by the DOJ. I don't know their full names, but I know it's Carey and Spaulding, the last names of the two officers. There was regularly, these cops were harassing store owners down there, and he caught them on videotape. He was recording them harassing the store owners, and it was Carey who asked him, videotape shows this. Says, "Why are you taping? Why do you have that camera on me?" And Father Manship said, "I'm taping what's going on here." And Carrie proceeded to arrest Father Manship. And it was after the video came out, that's what really caused the furor, because the officer had lied and said, "Well, oh, I thought he was pointing a gun at me." But the videotape showed clearly he said the words, "Why are you pointing a camera at me?" So the video tape clearly showed that he was lying. And really, as a result of that tape, there was such an uproar over that. That's when the Department of Justice got involved and started their investigation, which resulted in the indictment of the four officers, which, you know, as you mentioned, they're known as Miller's Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant, I guess his name is Miller, they've all been indicted for harassing and brutalizing Latinos. So,
I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but last year we had in the State House a reaffirmation of citizens' rights to videotape police in public space. Is that directly sprung out of that incident?
I'm not sure. I know that bill, you talk about Senator Loney's bill.
I don't know. I'm going from memory.
Yeah, he was the proponent of that bill. I don't know if that was a result of the Father Manship incident.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that it was a big subject of debate. I think what
I see that as a positive step forward.
Oh, definitely. I think I'm not sure what it ended up happening with that bill. I think, as a matter of fact, I think it's still being debated this session.
Oh, I know it was brought up to the public comment and so forth, and it passed that. Okay.
I guess what they were talking about doing was putting some language in there in terms of the police wanted to have language in there about that the person couldn't record if they were interfering with police activity, which is really ambiguous language.
Yeah, of course. They
could
say
really be,
else.
You know, manipulated.
Right.
So you know, I'm not sure exactly what's happening with that bill right now, but I think that's the last thing I heard was there was still debate going on about what language is going to be.
Right, because all around the country we're seeing officers just going crazy because they say, "Oh, I felt threatened." So they walk up to someone with a cell phone and they just, you know, either arrest them or confiscate their camera. You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a really scary thing, I think, for the police to know that, there is a society that's armed with electronic devices that can actually record their conduct. Because what you usually have happen is just what you said, is, you know, the cops do whatever they do, whether it's, you know, beat somebody up or shoot them. And then what it is, it's, you know, their word against, you know, whoever they assaulted or shot. And you know,
like the Bay Area Rapid Transit, BART.
Exactly. Now that was a shooting that was caught on cell phones.
By multiple cell phones, and they went around the platform and they took the people's phones, but they didn't get into the car on the opposite side of the train track where people were videotaping them through the train windows.
Yep. And what's unfortunate is even with that evidence, that officer, Johannes Meserle, he only did maybe like a year and change.
Mm-hmm.
He's out now.
Mm-hmm.
It shows even when these incidents are caught on tape, there's still justice is not, full justice is not being achieved, but it would definitely be better to have citizenry that are able to record the police than not, absolutely. Again, if it wasn't for Father Manship, the situation in East Haven, the feds still might not have gotten it.
Right.
But now, the Justice Department investigation and the indictment that the feds brought, I guess it was in January of this year, against the East Haven cops suggest this wasn't they say this wasn't an isolated incident, right? There was a systematic a program of unreasonable searches and in fact, beatings, too, right?
Yep. The indictment described what they termed a culture of corruption. This was behavior that was it wasn't like the brass at the EHPD were looking the other way. They were supporting this behavior. Gallo, who recently stepped down, mm-hmm. he was stonewalling.
This is the police chief, right?
Yeah, the police chief. He was stonewalling against the investigation.
In fact, isn't he listed as co-conspirator number one in the indictment? The
yes,
police chief.
Yes,
but
yes,
not by name,
is.
Though.
No, he's just unnamed co-conspirator
that's
number
speculated,
one. I think it's generally understood to be him. Okay.
Yeah, his lawyer, it hasn't, he hasn't been officially named, but his lawyer acknowledges that he is co-conspirator one.
Okay.
And Gallo was, he's the Bull Connor of East Haven.
And then he resigns in April of 2010.
He's going to get a full pension.
But then he was reinstated by the mayor a few months later, who was, I guess, his friend. And
what happened originally was April Capone, who was Maturo's predecessor. Actually, wasn't April Capone. It was, I think, the mayor before her that had originally taken. Gallo had taken him out of that position and put him in animal control because he said that Gallo was not fit to deal with humans.
Wow.
And when
that's pretty heavy.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. And when Maturo won the election and regained office, one of his first acts, it might have been his very first act, was to reinstate Gallo, yes.
And then he got to retire, and as you say, with a full pension.
With a full pension, and my understanding now is that Carrie has also applied for a disability pension for a disability retirement.
It's amazing.
Just to make a point, though, this is systemic in American government. This is a bigger case because this is law enforcement, but we have incompetence at every level of government. In Greenwich, Connecticut, where we live, there was a trunk sewer system thing that they were installing in the Riverside, Mianus part of Greenwich, and that was so poorly oversaw that it ended up going over budget by tens of millions of dollars. And the people who had basically allowed the original construction company who screwed it up to get away scot-free and without any liability, they go ahead and they retire with their full pensions and just leave town so that it's now the next incoming group's responsibility to fix this. And then they end up sticking all the local citizens with the bill.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about, the systemic issue, I mean, we're encountering it at the state capitol with our racial profiling bill. I mean, there's really a structured effort by legislators and bureaucrats there. I put Mike Lawler in there who is not if you go on his Facebook page, he does not talk about the racial profiling issue at all. Mm-hmm. And this is the right now under the current Penn Act bill, SB 364, an act concerning traffic stop information, OPM would be the primary the agent towards enforcing and overseeing the Penn Act. And Lawler is someone who has a very cozy relationship with the police. But despite the fact that he used to represent East Haven, if you go on his Facebook page, you won't see anything about the East Haven police scandal. You won't see anything about the Trayvon Martin case. The fact that he is silent on the issue of racial profiling, that's very disturbing, and it's indicative that he does not want to see the strongest racial profiling bill passed. And for him to have that attitude, he has to be accountable to one other person, and that's the governor. And so that's telling me that the governor isn't interested.
But David, I'd like to get into talk in detail about the Penn Act, but let me just give out the phone number. People want to call in and participate in this discussion that we're having right now on racial profiling. If you just tuned in, we're talking with David Samuels about racial profiling, and then the shame of the show is In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM. And our call-in number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. 336-9756. Call in and join the conversation. David, the Penn Act, there is a Penn Act which is supposed to deal with racial profiling in Connecticut. What does it provide, and is it been, has it been effective?
Well, this is the thing, is the mainstream narrative about the Penn Act has really been distorted. The fatal flaw of the Penn Act is that when it comes to the data collection piece, the citizen is excluded from that process.
Well, the data is collected when people are, any time a person is stopped by law enforcement.
Yes, but here's the problem.
Something's supposed to happen. A report's supposed to be generated.
Here's the problem. It's supposedly, you know, the police are supposed to turn in the data to the African American Affairs Commission, who are supposed to process this data. But here's the problem. The DOJ investigation found that the East Haven cops who were indicted, they were lying on those traffic stop demographic data forms. Some cases they weren't filling them out, and in other cases they were lying on the forms they were putting.
So the Penn Act requires that if you stop a motorist, and as I understand it, that's a particularly prevalent form of racial profiling, mm-hmm. that the policeman is supposed to fill out a form indicating why he stopped the person and the race of the person.
Why you stopped the person, the race of the person, but the DOJ, there was a DOJ investigation, and also the Yale Law School students, they also did a report on the East Haven police. Both the DOJ and the Yale Law School students found that the East Haven officers that have been indicted, that they were lying on the form. So I'm not naive enough to think that those East Haven cops are the only cops in the state who are falsifying those forms.
Were the forms actually delivered? I mean, were people, were towns producing them?
What was supposed to happen is the information is supposed to go to the African American Affairs Commission, but by the time it gets to the African American Affairs Commission, there's no names on there. It's just demographic data, and some of it comes in paper form, some of it is sent electronically. That was a point of contention there, that there wasn't a uniform. Way of submitting data.
Were the towns complying with the law?
It's right now it's only 27 of the towns that are complying, but even that I think is where, again, people are missing the point, because what the problem is right now is that data is corrupt, because,
right.
again, you have the East Haven cops who were found by the DOJ and the Yale Law School students to be lying on the forms. Certainly they aren't the only cops that are doing that. So what you have a situation is, even if somebody backed up a truck full of money to the Capitol today and all that data was collected and every police station complied, you're still dealing with corrupt data. So that's why the community party introduced a provision called a traffic stop receipt, which would it simply sounds really fancy, but all it is we're asking that the form that currently the cops have to fill out, that it be issued in duplicate and a copy be given to the driver. And we think that's the fatal flaw of the Penn Act, is that the citizen is totally excluded from the enforcement process. We feel if the motorist gets a copy of that form, it will act as a deterrent to officers to falsifying the form. And I think then, you know, when you've had that system in place for a while where the citizen has the same record of traffic stop data that the cops do, then you have a better look at what's going on with racial profiling in the state. But actually, it would probably, if these cops know that they have to give the driver a copy of the receipt, I think it will act as a deterrent to profiling.
David, is there a constant theme that was reappearing in the falsified documents to say that there was a certain type of profiling going on?
The DOJ found that the Latino drivers in East Haven were being listed as white on the falsified forms.
Okay, that's interesting. Ken and I actually spoke to an East Haven police officer somewhat recently about this case. And he was explaining to us, and he's not, and just to be clear, not one of the officers indicated in this report or anything like that. He's completely unrelated to it.
Yep.
And he was telling us a story about how there was a epidemic of basically false license plates that were being sold to illegal immigrants from the state of, I think it was Tennessee, And it was in the number of excess of 3,000 license plates that were being sold. So basically what the cops were doing were looking for these out-of-state license plates because there was a very high chance that they were illegal. And I'm curious as to whether that still qualifies as profiling, because is that not probable cause?
Well, I think anybody who wants to know what was going on with this case, they need to read the Department of Justice report on this case.
Mm-hmm.
The police, they can pull anything, you know, I'll not curse, they can pull anything out of thin air that they want to pull out to justify what they were doing. But the Department of Justice report, it very clearly lays out what was going on with the East Haven Police Department.
Right. I just want to lay out both sides of the potential, you know, issue here, because our show is all about context and people understanding.
Well,
why
I don't think that a fake license plate warrants people getting beat in the police station.
No. Clearly not.
And I also don't think that it warrants all of the falsified. If these were legitimate traffic stops, mm-hmm. why were the cops lying on the forms?
Because from what we understand is that they were told by the Department of Justice to, of course, not profile, and in order to do their job, they felt that they had to change the forms.
Hold on a second. Okay, go ahead.
No, it's fine. I'm going to let you speak. No problem.
Mm-hmm.
They also had difficulty with immigration. They had many felons, people with felony records that they were holding who were illegal, and they would call into immigration as they were supposed
to say. That's actually false, and I think that people need to read Seth Wessler of ColorLines.com. He did an excellent expose mm-hmm. on how the East Haven police were working with ICE, mm-hmm. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, mm-hmm. to deport immigrants. Even after the DOJ investigation started and the numbers they found was actually the majority of the people that they were deporting, the way it's supposed to work, I think, is they're supposed to have it's supposed to be a criminal charge involved, but you had people that were being detained just because they didn't have a driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people need to go to that report. It's colorlines.com, Seth Wessler. He did an excellent investigative report on how the East Haven Police and ICE have been working together to deport immigrants from that town. To me, that story that you said about, you know, why they're using to justify lying on the forms, mm-hmm. they need to tell it to the judge.
Okay,
right. I just want to give out our phone number again, 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. In context, we're talking to David Samuels about racial profiling. And also, if you don't want to be on the air yourself, you can drop us an email to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. We have our laptops open, so you'll get your question, your comment, or your experience right away, and we can read it on the air. Gus, you had a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to continue in the line of question here. David, I honestly, I'm just trying to get your feedback on these comments. These are not, you know, I'm not reporting, this is just reporting here.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would you propose? Obviously, violence aside, because violence is inexcusable, and I don't look at things from a minority rights type of point of view. I look at it from a human rights point of view, and we're all human beings, and we all have the same rights. So if my rights are being detained as a, you know, whatever race I am, then you need to be protected. But how do you think we should modify the system to deal with illegals who are breaking the law? Of course, no violence is allowed. But if I'm stopped and I don't have a license or a registration, then obviously my car gets impounded and I get a stiff fine. But illegals, they're let go typically. What do you think?
Well, I have a problem with that term, illegals.
Well, if you're in the country illegally, then
they're undocumented immigrants.
They're breaking the law to be here, aren't they?
Well, they're not the ones that are facing a federal indictment right now, are they?
No, but that's a different point.
You know, if anyone, you know, is not, you know, they're pulled over and legal means, they're discovered to be an undocumented immigrant or whatever, yeah, you got to go through whatever process you got to go through. But I think that's really, like, clouding the issue, which you're bringing up right now, because I'm going to go back to that DOJ report where the lays out in detail how these people were being brutalized at the East Haven police station.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just talked about you don't believe in minority rights, you believe in human rights. Well, how about the rights of a person, whether they're an undocumented immigrant or they're a documented immigrant? No one should be beaten in a police station.
Well, yeah, of course, as David suggests, or mentions, then the indictment includes a laundry list of incidents in which various officers allegedly used excessive force, struck individuals, rammed their head against the wall.
So to me, anyone that's interested in human rights, that's what they should be focusing on. I'm not going to get into an immigration debate.
Okay.
Because that's not what this is about. This is about racist cops who are targeting powerless people who, first of all, they knew, other than Father Manship, these were voiceless people. Because the way that the law is set up right now, they knew that there would be no way that these people would be able to go and complain anywhere, because, you know, like I said, when people are stopped, they're not given any kind of record that they can bring.
And clearly that's wrong.
Excuse me, David, Gus, we have a caller on the line. I'd like to join the conversation.
Yes, this is Jeff from Easton. Go ahead, Jeff. You're on the air with WPKN.
Yeah, a few months ago I searched out this, I don't know how I stumbled into this, but the court has ruled that the public has a right to video the police in public places.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in many places there have been laws passed which make it legal for the cops to videotape you.
Sure.
Not video, you can't video them, which obviously is completely absurd.
Right.
Definitely.
So people can find that if they just search in Google, just search Boston court right to video,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see this ruling that came down from, you know, the court that's just below the Supreme Court. So it's pretty cool.
I think we dropped the call there. That's too bad.
Somebody's calling me.
Okay.
It's okay. We'll just let them. It's going to beep again, but it's all right. So it's pretty cool that we have been told that we do have the right to do it, even though, you know, some places think that that's not legal.
Right, and the government has an unlimited right to surveil us with traffic cameras or, you know, cameras on every building, it seems, and they're able to even put, you know, we had the Supreme Court ruling saying you can't put GPS trackers on people's cars without a warrant, where they were doing that, you know, with unlimited, right. And then if someone tries to just videotape an officer on the street, then, you know, they get slapped with a federal wiretapping charge or some ridiculous thing.
And, of course, this whole racial profiling subject that we're talking about today started with the videotape by a Reverend Joseph Manship in East Haven, as he videotaped police harassing members of his community.
You know, what's amazing is how much the video footage has not often resulted in the cops suffering any consequence. It was Rodney King, and I guess we could go on and on about all those people who...
Oscar Grant.
You know, got beaten up by the cops, and yet, you know...
What was the Oscar Grant case? What was that?
Oscar Grant was shot in the back while he was laying on his stomach and handcuffed. He was shot in his back on the subway platform.
This is the San Francisco?
Oakland.
Yeah, Oakland.
I'm sorry, Oakland.
Yeah, it was caught on cell phone cameras by numerous people who were on the trains, who were on the platform, and the cop that murdered him ended up with a manslaughter charge and is out now, as a matter of fact. He served like a year and some change.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Jeff. And we'd also like to hear calls from any people out there who perhaps have experienced racial profiling. And we'd like to hear your story. It's 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756.
And if I could just, you know, interject, go back to something that was said earlier about how this isn't, you know, like a minority issue.
Mm-hmm. Right, Dave.
You know, yeah. I think, you know, this is a thing where, you know, I think we need to deal in facts. You know, the Department of Justice has found that blacks and Latinos are 3 to 4 times as likely to be searched and arrested and subjected to the use of force during traffic stops than whites. So color is, you know, it cannot be avoided as a factor.
It's empirical, right?
Yeah. It can, you know, it cannot be taken out of the equation.
And we have a call.
Oh, sorry. This is Michael from New Haven. Sorry, I forgot to turn my mic on again.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for calling, and you're on the air.
Yes, how are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
As far as videotaping the cops, the cops have found a way to get around it. Have you heard?
In what way? Stealth cloaks or something?
Very simple. Once there's sound, they got you for wiretap. You hear about that one?
Yes, I actually mentioned that a few minutes ago.
Yes, they can get you for wiretap.
Which is wrong.
But still it holds up. They got a guy locked up now.
I know.
Oh, you mean like if you videotape them, they can use the wire, or you record them, they can use the wiretapping?
Yeah, because you've recorded their voice.
Yeah, I heard about that.
They're accusing you of wiretapping them.
Yes. I wasn't making that up a second ago.
The ironic thing is ironic thing is that the government can, you know, wiretap you anytime they want. You know, Patriot Act, wonderful thing. Yeah. They can wiretap you. You just can't record them doing, you know, what they shouldn't be doing.
A caller, have you ever used your a video camera for?
No, I haven't.
Yeah,
but I'd like to say something real quick. As far as the racial profiling, I like what New York does. When you're stopped in a thing, they use a SB-201 form and they give you a copy, because New York right now has the highest rate of racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the New York Times in Brownsville, New York. They've been stopping people like something like 300,000 people in a 6-year span.
Right, it's tens of thousands of people
a
year.
And also now NYPD can come into private buildings and stop you and question you.
Right.
Has it had any effect, this law in New York, in reducing racial profiling?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
Has the law in New York State had any effect?
Well, Governor Patterson, that was in Gutter, for what I read, I come from New York, he said basically they were keeping the data. He wrote a law, they can't keep the data. Now, you have Councilman Charles Barron, a good friend of mine, who's fighting this law now, along with other councilmen. Because a lot of councilmen have been stopped under that search law. New York leads the country right now in search and stop and frisk law, which I think will be coming to New Haven with his new police chief, Esserman. I think he's going to start that eventually. As far as you were talking about the community bankings?
Yes, sir.
I'm more for, like, the old school. We ran the numbers. The numbers trade took care of the black community. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you for calling, Michael.
Thank you, sir.
You know, I think that, David, a lot of people may think, well, big deal, you're stopped at by a policeman at a traffic light, and he asks you questions, you're stopped. What's the big deal? And what is the experience like for the people who haven't had that experience?
It's a big deal if they don't have probable cause.
But, I mean, what is the experience like from the perspective of the person who has been stopped? How does it affect his feelings towards authority, towards policemen, his sense of privacy? What's kind of going on psychologically when you're in that situation?
Clearly that individual is going to feel that the police aren't there to protect them, but are rather there to bust them. And so if you the problems of lack of trust between the urban community and the police are well documented, and I think that's, you know, the thing where, you know, if somebody is stopped and they know that there was no probable cause for the stop, if there was an illegal search that went down, and if there was a brutality. I don't know if you heard about, this wasn't a traffic stop, but I don't know if you heard about the case in New York where a black 60-year-old veteran was shot to death by the police. He accidentally triggered his medic alert bracelet, and the police came to his door. The man says that he did not need help. The argument ensued where racial slurs were used by the officers, and this was caught on tape because the medic alert thing that the guy was using, it was recording the conversation. and the DA like won't release the tape, but it's been confirmed that racial slur was used on the office by one of the officers. So what ended up happening was is the cops busted down the door and they shot this 68-year-old man with a heart condition with a taser and killed him. They shot him and killed him. So you know, when we talk about the feelings between, you know, the black community and the Latina community and the police, we already talked about Rodney King, we already talked about Oscar Grant, now you have, you know, Kenneth Chamberlain, a 70-year-old, you know, this is a veteran. This is a man who served his country they teach us to do in school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his reward for that was he got shot and killed by the police. So, you know, that's the situation where, that's just three out of how many stories, stories of blacks being killed by the police. I mean, I think it's pretty self-explanatory how the black community would have to feel towards law enforcement.
I mean, I don't even have a good attitude toward law enforcement. I'm not any race, actually. I'm such a mixture of races that no one can even tell what I am.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I do get weird looks from cops and stuff like that. I've been profiled in airports.
Statistically, I gave you the numbers.
Yeah, I know. But the point, I mean, I feel bad for.
So that's why I said, we got to move away from rhetoric and we got to deal with the facts. And the facts are that blacks and Latinos are more likely to be searched, arrested and subjected to the use of force during traffic stops than whites.
We only have about 5 minutes left in the program, so if you'd like to give us a ring and join the conversation, please call now. We're at 203-336-9756. 203-336-9756. We're talking to David Samuels, founder of Connecticut's Community Party, about racial profiling, and the name of the show is In Context on WPKN. David, do you think that the problem of racial profiling relates would be somewhat alleviated by the... Marchand, did you...
March had a comment.
I'm sorry, Marchand has a question.
I was just going to say the historical note, but the British had a foray, if you will, with racial profiling during the Troubles in Ireland. This was the warring period when the IRA in the 70s, 80s, and 90s were blowing stuff up in England, and they were stopping all people of Irish descent traveling to and from England. Mm-hmm. And they found that this was not an effective means whatsoever for combating terrorism or crime, for that matter. They found that you couldn't profile a group successfully and expect any reduced statistically in crime or terrorism. But we do the same thing in airports. Whenever, my girlfriend's a Muslim and she wears a scarf, and every time she goes to the airport, she gets searched, her bag gets searched. She's an Arab American.
Yeah.
Well, we heard, what was happening with the NYPD, what they were doing with the surveilling Yale Law School students. I'm glad that you raised that point, because the Community Party's PEN Act amendment, it includes an enforcement provision which would ban patrol officers from profiling anyone on the basis of their religion.
Very good. And I think we have one more call, Marchand.
Oh, 1 moment.
Yeah.
I'm multitasking.
Okay.
This is Mr. Edwards from New Haven, Connecticut. Go ahead.
Mr. Edwards, go ahead.
Thank you for calling, Mr. Edwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have in my hand a copy of the New Haven Police Department complaint number, as well as the incident code from August of 2008. And I will read it very briefly, okay? My name is George Edwards of New Haven, Connecticut, and here's what the police incident report said. A suspect communication service, or the New Haven Police Department communication service, received a telephone call from two anonymous callers who stated a black male left Starbucks and walked across the New Haven Green toward the courthouse. He is waving a large knife. I am concerned he is going to hurt someone. The caller described the suspect with the knife as a male black person with a white bandana, shades of black pants, blue, whatever, striped shirt. The caller then just called back and told us, the police department, the suspect was near the stage where he stopped and ordered and he was ordered to the ground by the New Haven Police Department. The suspect complied, and so forth and so on. Now, let me say this very briefly. I was 70-some years old. I am now almost 75 years old. And the police officer who ran toward me with his gun threatening to blow my brains out and told me to get down on the ground had been harassing me for 20-some years. I will make this report available to anyone. A suspect black male, 70-some years old. The cops were surprised when they checked my ID and my age. I was not threatening anyone. I was working to set up the New Haven Jazz Festival on the stage. I left the stage to go to Starbucks to get the coffee. So a racist white male called this in. The police ran toward me with a gun and forced me down on the ground, and one officer jumped on my back. I'm disabled with a permanent spinal injury, and three other officers ran up. They didn't pull their guns. So when we talk about racial profiling, I am a victim for decades of this, and this is the most current event.
Did you get any remedy for that? I mean, was anything done about what happened to you?
With respect to who?
Well, I mean, were you able to? The police department ever do anything with it?
The police department.
Yeah.
You're asking me, was anything done? And I put the question back to you, done by whom?
I mean, did you complain to the police department, and then did the police department take any action with regard to your complaint?
Almost done.
Well, first of all, I am an original leader of the Black Panther Party in Connecticut, George W. Edwards. And I know I will never, ever get any justice in pursuing my rights through the police department or the Justice Department.
And
if I could jump in,
he's making a very good point about the police should not be the ones where people should have to take their complaints. Another piece of our legislation would require that a agency that's independent of law enforcement, that they would investigate any racial profiling complaints. As a matter of fact, I know we don't have much time left. I want to tell people to check out our Facebook page.
Thank you for calling, Mr. Edwards, with that history. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, David.
I want to tell people that if they're interested in supporting learning more about the Community Parties Bill and supporting our effort to get our language passed, they should go visit our Facebook page at Stop Racial Profiling, Obey the Law. We've got an action alert right now. We want people to contact their legislators and also Mike Lawler, Office of Policy and Management, and tell them to support our language. So that action alert can be found in the notes section of our page, and we also regularly post it on our wall. We will need tremendous public support to have any chance of our language being passed by the legislature. And also our complete bill language can also be found in the notes section.
All right, David, we're going to have to leave it there.
Thanks so much for joining us. That's David Samuels, the founder of Connecticut's Community Party. We've been talking about racial profiling. You've been listening to In Context.
The website is incontextreport.com. Find us on YouTube, youtube.com/incontextreport. And you can find us on Facebook.
And we'll be on next week at noon.
That's right. See you next time.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.